It's the Wonky Show, and we have all the reports. We'll go through IFS's work on the graduate premium. We'll look at Happy's take on how graduate employability has changed universities. And we'll dive into Million Plus's ideas for how to level up higher technical education. And some student politics as we tackle Turning Point UK. It's all coming up.
And it was on the front page of many newspapers. But when we looked into it, and it was really clear that what was happening is that some staff who had liberal views were challenging themselves to make sure that they felt that students who were Conservatives were able to be supported in articulating their views and writing messages.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Jim Dickinson, and as usual, we have three excellent guests. In Brighton, Adam Tickell is the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Sussex. Adam, your highlight of the week, please.
I've spent some time with one of our most distinguished and impressive alumni, Albie Sachs, who was one of the heroes of the South African freedom struggle. He was blown up in a bomb in Mozambique, but has the most humanitarian, just wonderful approach. And it is a real privilege to be with him.
And in New Cross, Selina Bolingbroke is the Lead for External Engagement and Strategic Development at Goldsmiths University of London. Selina, your highlight of the week, please.
I suspect the highlight of my week hasn't happened yet, because it's going to happen this afternoon when I'm facilitating a community conversation to talk about how we can do more to have impact in our local community.
Excellent. Right. So, yes, we start this week with the news that one in five students would be financially better off if they just skipped higher education altogether, according to new research that compares the lifetime earnings of graduates and non-graduates. Analysis by the Institute for Fiscal Studies found that while 80% of former students gained financially from attending university, about 20% earned less than those with similar school results. Selina, what's going on?
Well, this is the third in a series of reports by the IFS, which were commissioned by the DfE, and they make use of the Longitudinal Education Outcomes, LEO, data set, which is aiming to improve information on the value of higher education degrees. So what this report does, it's based on an analysis of lifetime premiums, and part of what it highlights is the sort of failed financial gains for particular groups who study different subjects. Creative arts comes out very badly. Ironically, economics comes out as an earning success. And I think probably what would be a kind of considered view looking across the whole of the report is that the findings may well say more about the aspirations of the type of people who study on those courses than it does about the courses themselves. But some of the headlines, the data does show that the overall economic return of a degree, although there are obviously these disparities between men and women and across subjects, but on average, graduates will earn over £100,000 more in their lifetimes compared to their non-graduate peers. And I think one of the other important highlights from or headlines from this report is that regardless of subject, again, looking across the top, the Exchequer benefits through the tax system to the tune of around £100,000 per graduate over the lifetime. I think what we sort of feel as a reaction within the sector is that the research, which, as I say, was commissioned by the DfE, and its purpose being to provide more information on the value of higher education, has sparked off that conversation about higher education and how it's valued. And I think there are some fears about how the government might use this data in terms of funding policy and regulation. The new Universities Minister, Michelle Donnellan, did stress at the weekend that the data was intended to provide prospective students with better information. Personally, I kind of look at it and I think about the prospective students that I know, and I can't think for a moment that they would find this information either accessible or useful in terms of trying to help guide their choices of subject or indeed different universities, which is also a factor in terms of lifetime earnings. So to that extent, I think we can be sure that the data will be used, but it's much more likely to be used by politicians and policymakers rather than individual students.
Yeah, and Adam, to that end, this is great news, isn't it? There's 20% that aren't benefiting, so we just need to find those courses and switch funding to FE, don't we?
Well, I think that, we need to take this seriously, don't we? But I think there are three real problems with the IFS report, and it's really disappointing that the IFS have done it. The first of them is that what they're doing is they're comparing the general graduate population with the general non-graduate population. So it may be true, for example, that a graduate museum curator earns less than a non-graduate city trader. But the IFS report does not analyse the data to tell you whether someone who works in the arts or the city is better off as whether they go to university or not. And that for me is a fundamental flaw. So, you know, you do creative arts, you get less well paid than if you're an economist. And that's just a fact of life, irrespective of your route in. I think the second two problems were highlighted by David Kernahan in a piece on the Wonky blog, which unpacks the data in really useful ways. So firstly, he shows that they don't distinguish between people who attend university and people who complete university. And inevitably, people who drop out for one reason or another are much less likely to have higher graduate earnings than people who complete the course. And finally, there's a discount rate that's applied to earnings in, later on in life, which is higher for people. So, you know, fundamentally, if you're in a high-paid job, then that discount rate reduces your lifetime earnings. So it's a real shame because this report plays into a narrative that university education is only should only be for a fewer number of people than it is now. But fundamentally, the data don't tell us, lead us to those conclusions.
Yeah, and that's I mean that is the interesting question, isn't it, Selina? And it's what kind of use, given all the limitations on it, what kind of use might this data be put to? You know, is this, you know, when you say this is probably more of use to policymakers, what might they do with it?
Well, I think this is the worrying thing, because I think it's hard to see how this is going to be used in a positive way to make improvements to the way in which, you know, the funding system works to support the future skills needs of the labour market. I think one of the things that we know about the way in which the knowledge economy has developed is that actually the really big, innovative and successful projects in industry come through a combination of discipline skills. You know, at Goldsmiths, we talk a lot about the STEAM agenda. So actually it is the combination of science, technology, engineering, arts and mathematics that is often required in a team context to be able to innovate and to build successful technology for the future. And I think the kind of narrative that this report plays into is one where it is reductive. As Adam has said, it is very much around thinking about how do you create the evidence base so that you reduce the value of the number of students going into universities. And of course, this is completely at odds with what we know about the demographics over the next 5 to 10 years, where we're expecting the number of young people who will want to go to university and who indeed will be needed by our economy to have higher level skills to increase, not decrease. So this seems to be very much around political, ideological objectives and not about either the needs of young people or the needs of the economy.
But let me pose you both a question. So obviously, the Brown Review in 2010 and then Students at the Heart of the System in 2011 both effectively pointed to the idea that if you gave lots of applicants lots of data, they would make intelligent choices. And the message over the past couple of years seems to be students keep making the wrong choices in terms of the future of the economy. So if you're a kind of policymaker and there isn't all the money in the world and a big demographic bulge coming, what do you do? Do you persist with giving graduates information and hope they make the right choices? Or do you have number controls? I mean, how do you influence practically this, you know, in quotes, market if, students keep making the, in quotes, wrong decision?
I have to say, I mean, I've always been incredibly sceptical and cynical about this notion that young people in particular are going to be equipped with all this information to make these rational decisions. I've got a 14-year-old who's making his key stage 4 BTEC GCSE option choices at the moment, which is really where the decisions are being made as to whether or not you go to university and what kind of course you might end up on. You know, it doesn't actually start with your UCAS application. Of course it doesn't. You know, so he's 13, 14. And what is quite interesting that I've noticed from that is that the support he's had through school in terms of careers planning, they do look at likely careers earnings. And of course, when you're sort of, 13, 14 and surviving on £5 dog walking pocket money every week, that can be quite persuasive. But, I just think that one of the things is that young people's behaviour is not, well, I say young people, people's behaviour is not always impacted by rational information, but I think particularly so young people, because they're not able to put it within a meaningful context. I think the second thing is the quality of information provided here, as the report authors themselves say, is that it's not knowable today what retirement patterns are going to look like in 50 years' time and whether those earning trajectories of future graduates will be similar to those of past graduates, not least because past graduates weren't subject to a mass higher education system. So, you know, the kind of data forecasts that, or data analysis rather, that rely on forecasts, there is always going to be some uncertainty built into that. So there is no sense where this can credibly be taken as a, you know, part of the information data set that will be useful for students who are making choices.
But Adam, I guess Selena highlights the killer question, doesn't she? So if, you know, if applicants don't have all the data and aren't making rational decisions, but we have a demand-led system, don't we have a problem?
I think we need not to be too defensive about it. And I think so. I think as ever in these things, there's nuance rather than absolutes. So there are some real workforce planning issues. You know, we know that we're not going to have enough nurses. We know we're not going to have enough physiotherapists, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it is quite rational for policy to say we will put particular targeted interventions to grow students in medical schools, as is happening. The problem we've got is that the world is changing so rapidly, and there's some fairly good evidence to suggest that the jobs that we need now are not the jobs we're going to need in 10 or 15 years' time, because of AI has the potential to wipe out many of the things which look as if they can't be automated today. So, you know, economists always come out as being extraordinarily well paid, because they are. You can actually find ways of thinking about how economics is becoming de-skilled. So high-frequency trading has replaced traders in the city substantially. You need algorithms which operate on milliseconds, nanoseconds, rather than people who sit in trading floors waving bits of card and having strange hand movements to one another. And I think we just need to be a little bit more relaxed and think about playing into employability, and playing into equipping our students with the skills they need for a work life which is completely unpredictable. And an emphasis on a particular set of skills is actually going to be counterproductive for our economy.
Good, right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Liz Cleaver, University Director of Learning and Teaching at the University of the West of England. And my article, What Value and Whose Values, is a collaborative cross-border effort with Alistair Robertson, Abertay University, Fiona Smart, Edinburgh Napier University, and Paul Redford, one of my colleagues at UWE Bristol. The article argues that current sector trends, which focus on the value of higher education in terms of the things we can quantify and count, can miss some of the really important but less tangible aspects of our work. These intangible assets are often the things that form the heartbeat of the excellent education we're proud to offer. In the article, as an example, we consider moves in the sector to identify and commit to underpinning institutional values in all aspects of our work. Interestingly, at UWE, we now see our institutional values and our graduate attributes as one and the same. And evidence from outside higher education, from both the public and private sectors, certainly shows that values-driven organisations are psychologically as well as financially healthy. They outperform their competitors and attract and retain their staff. But values are really hard to quantify, and proxy metrics can't always do them justice. So the piece highlights the importance of evidencing and recognising our value beyond the metrics. Some of our most intangible assets in higher education are really important to us and to our students, and are key to our and to their future success.
Now, next up, 3/4 of career services have seen a change in student engagement with careers in the past 3 years. And the new Graduate Outcomes Survey and Office for Students Access and Participation Plans are having the biggest impact on how career services operate. That's just some of the things that are highlighted in a new policy note from HEPI that includes an analysis of a survey of heads of careers. Adam, tell us more.
So, as you say, this is a new HEPI report which explores the... which has a big focus on graduate employment and particularly takes the views of students, employers and policymakers into account. I think we need to think about the huge change in the policy environment that's been underway over the last decade or more. You know, the TEF has made a big difference. The Graduate Outcomes Survey has made a big difference. And we can now track graduate salaries via the Longitudinal Educational Outcome Survey, affectionately known as LEO. And what LEO allows us to do is to see... on a very granular basis by university and course, how students or how our graduates are faring 10 years after they graduate. And so you can say, for example, that an economics degree from LSE gives you a huge value added as compared to an economics degree from another university. And this is transformational. The survey that HEPI are reporting on, as you say, shows that there's been a major increase in career services over the last few years. But interestingly, our students are not interested in the salaries. What they're really interested in is their employability and getting the right job for them. And I think I read this as being really positive. You know, just as we were talking about dog walk, you know, earning £5 for walking the dog. I think our students are making rational choices about the kinds of lives they want to lead. And of course, when people are 20 and in their 20s, they have a fairly idealistic view of the world. And I think we ought to celebrate that. And so going into lower paid, fulfilling jobs is something that is absolutely positive from my perspective. I'll just say one other thing, though. I think what we found at Sussex is that this report really resonates. So our student union did a survey last year of what their students wanted most from the student union services. And to their surprise, what came back is they want the student union to provide them with employability skills. And so that's a big focus both for the union, but also for the university together. And I think the second thing I'd say is we need to focus on students who don't have access to traditional networks. So there's some really important work on thinking about how we equip students who come from non-traditional backgrounds to get internships, to get paid internships, to get jobs that they're not going to do. And at Sussex, we're doing some great work. And I know that King's College are doing some really interesting work in that domain too.
Selina, there's a rich seam of, you know, the organised expression of students objecting to the idea of employability being really important to students. But if it's the case that, you know, kind of Gen Z is less worried about salary but more interested in a fulfilling career, that puts a different spin on that idea that students are really into employability skills.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, my years of working in lots of different roles within the sector, that has not been my experience when you get down to the level of talking to the individual student. Not because they are motivated by their potential graduate earnings and how they kind of gain that, but actually I think one of the things that students really get both pleasure and learning out of is thinking about how what they've learned at university in terms of either knowledge or skills will apply in the workplace. They are getting more learning out of thinking about the application and the utility of their degree studies. And, you know, in the past, I've sort of spent a lot of time working in student unions. And I think that was always one of the really strong motivations, quite an intrinsic motivation for students to be involved in a lot of the activities around the kind of fringe of the student union that actually then played themselves out as good bridges into employment. I think that one of the things that I've picked up over the last probably 10 years or so, and it very much goes along with that rising awareness about the opportunities for students in terms of enterprise and entrepreneurship. Some years ago, I commissioned some research to look at student attitudes to enterprise and how they had changed. And one of the things that was quite marked and was repeated in successive years of doing this survey was that the reason why students wanted to go into enterprise or to set up their own business, it was very, very rarely about maximising their earnings. In fact, most of them were quite realistic that they were likely to earn less if they went down the route of self-employment. What was motivating them was the sense of autonomy. And I think with young people today, that becomes an increasingly important factor, certainly more so than I would guess it was with, you know, my own generation who went into university in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think we should be really conscious of that, because I think that does affect the kind of information that we should give from a career service perspective. It's not just about the way into a profession or into a job. It's about how we make most use of that job in terms of a wider career plan. And I think one of the things it might change in terms of the way in which we operate our career services, I suspect that over the next 10 years, what we will be doing much more of is the work with our alumni. Because I think increasingly people will be taking lots of small stepping stones into the workplace, and I think they'll need more support to maximise what they can bring to the workplace through the support of really high quality university career services.
So yeah, I mean, lots of positivity here and source for optimism. But back to the metrics. The last set of OFS board papers suggested that whilst we might not end up with graduate outcomes in a subject TEF very soon, it looks like OFS might at least publish some subject level employment outcomes. And you know what does that do, Adam, to, you know, the debate about, for example, whether you put employability into the curriculum or whether you boost up the, you know, the career service?
So listen, I've got mixed views about this. I don't think there's anything wrong with helping students to understand what they're going to get from a degree. But I think it's a real shame if what we say is doing a degree which is in life enhancing in all sorts of ways is something that we inhibit. Because doing creative arts degrees, doing a degree in English, doing a degree in history, they may not have a 1 year outcome or which gives you a high quality job. But, you know, fundamentally, they may give you a life which is fulfilling, and they may, lots of people who do that may not get a 1 year job because they've got the kind of oomph to go out and do it, spend a year traveling around the world or just enjoying themselves. So if we become so focused on a particular measure, what we do is we forget that the value of education is life enhancing as much as it's career enhancing.
And Selina, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at the three, you know, ONS collects data on the three classic markers of adulthood. So having a family, buying property, and getting married or civil partnership or whatever. And they're all now, you know, not far off 35. So if that reflects a wider change in the structure of the economy and people aren't kind of settling down into their career until they're sort of 33, 34, why on earth, given how young our graduate population is, are we looking at whether people have entered a graduate job in the first couple of years, 5 years, or even 10 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I'm not a data specialist, but I think it poses real problems in terms of the way in which we're using data sets, you know, that essentially are always focused on the experience of students and graduates in the past. We talked about this in terms of the IFS analysis of lifetime earnings. You know, these are people who are graduating into a different economy with a different proportion of graduates within the economy. And I think there are similar issues when we look at this education. I think the answer is that we just have to be really clear that this only provides part of the picture in terms of the information that people need. And I think inevitably in terms of what people really do, and this is why so much around the conversation around social mobility really has to go back into schools and colleges and sixth forms, but really what people use to kind of make their decisions is about their experience of people around them. And I think that that's a much more dominant factor in terms of the kind of choices that people will make about the options they study and how they might help them progress into different jobs in the future.
Now, next up then, Levelling Up, a million plus report published this week, analyses the state of higher technical education at levels 4 and 5 in England, arguing that policy debate in this arena makes too much of a distinction between college and university-based provision. Selina, fill us in.
Well, I have to repeat what's on the first line of the press release, because actually what it is calling on the government to do is to turbocharge technical education, which, you know, obviously is quite eye-grabbing, turbocharging. And I think that one of the points that the Million Plus report really kind of makes, and again, this is very much a report that is aimed at those policymakers, is that there is a lot of technical, higher level technical education that is already happening in universities. And I think from a million plus perspective, given that it is the Association of Modern Universities, that is perhaps felt that a point that is not well understood by policymakers generally, but I suspect this government in particular and this Secretary of State for Universities in particular. And actually, I think one of the things that comes out of this report is that it's not particularly helpful to keep making too much of a distinction between college and university-based provision. The other thing that this report does is it does highlight the decline of students taking sub-degree technical qualifications in universities, and that decline doesn't equate to where we know there are national deficits in technical skills at a higher level. So what the report does do is to call for reforms to student funding and to ensure that those providers of level 4 and 5 qualifications do register with the OFS, because of course that will then unlock the student funding system for their students, but also for better data collection around this. One of the things I particularly liked about this report in terms of the tone was that I think it recognised that good quality higher level technical education can be best delivered in partnership between higher and further education. And I think that that is something that has really, really suffered over the last few years, not least because I think colleagues in the FE sector have just been dealing with one of the most aggressive reductions in the unit of funding that we have seen in recent times, and certainly nothing like the funded experience within universities. I think the other thing that I would say about this, and there is a fantastic article on Wonky this week from the chair of Million Plus, but how it really reminds us that part of the problem is that for technical education at levels 4 and 5, within HE, our systems, whether they be funding systems, admission systems, or marketing systems, they are built for full-time degree entrants. So those systems are having to bend round the needs of those learners who may well be best suited for levels 4 and 5. I think there's a worry that there are some people who are best suited who are not accessing those qualifications and are instead going on to degrees because they may be easier to get onto. And I think, you know, that reflects back onto that conversation about how well equipped young people in particular are to make these decisions. I think the other side of it is that there are particularly mature learners who are simply not accessing these qualifications in the way that they would have done in the past. And I think, you know, part of the strengthening of provision of technical education is going to be the answer to building back more part-time learners, more mature learners, and indeed more working class learners within higher education. So I think it's a very helpful report. I hope that it does cut through to the policymakers and the new government about how this can be a really important plank in their aspirations to help the country level up.
Adam, the way the system works to kind of support the classic full-time student was also something that Universities UK raised this week. So, and one of the things that strikes me is that there are bits in both this report and UUK's letter that are actually shades of some of the more technical and less headline-y bits of Augur last year.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's some really important messages here coming through from this and coming through from the overall world we're in. The first, I think, is that universities do a great job. And, you know, just segueing back to our earlier conversations, people who are doing technical degrees in universities are probably unlikely to be the people who are going to be earning £100,000 a year and coming out and well in an IFS report in a decade or two's time. But they're people who are having their lives transformed, and universities are making the big difference. I think the other thing, as Selena says, is that we need to be really clear that we're not at war, and we mustn't allow ourselves to be made to go to war with further education. You know, I was going back to the Augur report as I read this, actually, and I just remembered that 38% of apprenticeships, according to the Augur report anyway, in 2017-18, were in areas of business, administration and law. And that's twice as many as apprenticeships were being undertaken in engineering. And so I think this division that's sometimes cast between FE and apprenticeships being the place where people get a real technical education and universities where we train FEET students to do creative classes is utterly wrong. And I think that Rama's report does the job really well in putting the light to that.
Selena, is part of the problem that Whitehall continues to divide up the sector in terms of universities and colleges rather than, you know, in other perhaps more creative ways?
Yeah, I think that absolutely is part of the problem. I also think, again, and this is a long-standing problem for Whitehall, certainly my experience when I worked in it, but people understand higher education essentially through the lens of their own experience. And that experience rarely encompasses any time spent in the FE sector. So I think that is a sector that is particularly...
Or higher technical.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think, you know, that those are areas that are particularly misunderstood and, you know, subject really to a lot of really unhelpful, you know, sort of points of view around where their value lies and indeed what those terms actually mean. I mean, you know... A lot of the creative subjects are vocational. I think, you know, certainly from an art school perspective, that our colleges started as vocational places of learning. And I think that we really do need to understand this, not just because it's about making things kind of fair across different providers, but because I think these questions sit at the heart of what is going to be fundamental to the innovation we need to make if we are to, you know, successfully transform our economy over the next 20 or 30 years, which is what I think is the big headline task ahead, you know, that it should be the headline task for the tertiary education sector as a whole, because the changes that are coming are going to be so profound that it requires that kind of big world shared view if we are going to be able to solve some of those problems.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that is not, at the time of recording, expecting a child with Boris Johnson. With all this talk on returns on creative arts study at the moment, we're taking a look at student numbers in the subject areas that make up that field. Many students described as studying creative arts are actually studying design, a much more vocational subject than perhaps many would imagine. But do providers with a big design provision also have a similar strength in fine arts? Do undergraduate first degree student numbers in these two very visual subjects correlate?
I'll take a tap at that. I think there probably isn't a big correlation between students with fine art and design. Design is probably more technical than fine art, so I'm guessing, really, to be honest, that there isn't a huge correlation.
Well, we do provide at Goldsmiths, we do have large design provision and large fine art provision. But I would, I think I would actually agree with, we are unusual, obviously, at Goldsmiths. I think I would agree with Adam, and I don't think there would be a correlation.
And the answer is yes, R squared is 0.74, suggesting a close relationship between the two fields. The University of the Arts and the University of the Creative Arts understandably dominate the field, but there's a strong showing from everywhere from Edinburgh to Nottingham Trent, via Falmouth. And the largest provider of fine art courses that does not offer design courses? The University of Newcastle. Data is from HESA and does not include designated courses at alternative providers. Where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, self-proclaimed student movement Turning Point UK launched an initiative called Education Watch this week to tackle what it calls the endemic left-wing bias of UK university teaching. Adam, surely there's plenty of videos from your place on there.
You know, it's fairly weary that we see the return of the free speech wars to universities. I don't know whether there are videos from us. I don't think there are. I think the videos they put up so far seem to be fairly small beer, and I don't think they're from my university. I think we need to be really clear that it's absolutely critically important that students are given the full range of intellectual and political perspectives in their classes and that they feel supported to come to their own reasoned conclusions. But what's happening here is that Turning Point has set up this thing where they're suggesting students send videos that then can be paraded on social media. I have to say, I'm sure I'm not alone in finding that faintly sinister. Clips can be seized out of context, and any short video is just not going to get the nuance of what's going on in the classroom. So it's quite conceivable that a member of staff will say something that, if you take out of context, sounds as if it's offensive. And we have examples of that where there was a furore a few years ago about a seminar that was entitled Teaching Right-Wing Attitudes in the Classroom. And it was on the front page of many newspapers. But when we looked into it, and it was really clear that what was happening is that some staff who had liberal views were challenging themselves to make sure that they felt that students who were conservatives were able to be supported in articulating their views and writing essays as such. So I think sometimes we just need to be really careful about creating a climate of fear. And that applies both to students and staff who are conservatives, but to staff who aren't too.
Selena, I mean, you know, one of the videos shows a science lecturer telling students that they need to think like scientists, not Daily Mail readers. You know, surely that's unacceptable. Surely you can be a scientist and a Daily Mail reader.
I'm sure you can, but even if you're a Daily Mail reader, you need to think more like a scientist if you're in a science lab, don't you? I was going to say, one of the things that I worry about with these kinds of initiatives is how this looks from the outside, actually. I think, you know, Adam spoke very well about how these things can be seen internally and how potentially they can inhibit and indeed intimidate a sense of academic freedom and free speech. But I also look outside and think about the work that we do around civic engagement and think, you know, what does the average person who, as we know from some other research that UPP did and released a couple of weeks ago, who may never have visited a university campus, who hasn't been to university themselves, what do they think about universities and their value to society? I sense that, you know, these things, when they get press, airtime, it does make us feel as if, or it makes us seem as if, we are very much in this separate bubble and we are not living the lives of other people. And I think it makes it harder for us to demonstrate not just our value, but our relevance to people's lives. And I think we're all conscious that that is something that we may have lost in the, over the last few years and in the context of the sort of post-referendum period, the Brexit debate and so on. So that's one of the things that does worry me. It's not so much about the views of the Daily Mail reader, but, you know, the person who perhaps doesn't read a daily newspaper, that isn't part of their lives, but they pick up bits and pieces off social media. And I think it doesn't create a great impression of higher education as a whole.
Adam, look, all the surveys of students suggest that they are left-leaning, and same with academics. And I guess if you're Julian Brazier, the former MP in Canterbury, one of the tempting things to do is to blame the expansion of the university for, you know, Canterbury of all seats suddenly going to the Labour Party.
Well, you might do. There's a very well established pattern that people who are younger tend to be more left wing than people who are older, and actually that's as true for people who aren't students as it is true for students. I think there's a broader point though, and I think we need to recognise that many people, and I think Selina was touching on this, but policymakers included, see universities as being on the wrong side of the culture wars. And I think we do need to counter this. And we need to counter this by being clear that we welcome debate, that we welcome challenge, and critically, that we welcome a diversity of views. And in honesty, that kind of thing can be difficult. It can be difficult for legal reasons. Under the Prevent legislation and under the Public Sector Equalities Duty, there are different pressures on us. But if universities stand for anything, it genuinely must be for freedom of thought. And for that, that means that when we need to recognise that when people disagree with us, whether they're conservatives or socialists or feminists or whatever they may be, they do so not because they're bad people or because they have bad motivations, but because they have different interpretations of the world. And I think if we're really open and radically open to different views and different thoughts, then I think we'll go a long way to assuaging some of our critics.
And Selina, to some extent, we arrive back at that kind of age-old debate that has surrounded No Platform, don't we? Which is, you know, for some people saying some things is, you know, marks out an environment to be unsafe. But for others, you know, the very act of having that debate is what causes the eventual safety.
Yeah. I think when I was a student, East London Poly in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, the no platforming that was used then within the context of the Students' Union was quite often against BNP speakers, National Front speakers, and, you know, it was the time of the Stephen Lawrence murder. And I think that there was a real fear that, particularly given where we were in East London, and the kind of, you know, demographics around us in terms of where the campus was situated, there was a real worry that genuinely some of our students may have been not just made to feel unsafe, but have been under threat had those speakers got a hold of a platform on campus. I think that what has changed is that there is a much broader application of that sense of no platform and of that kind of cancel culture. And I think that is problematic. One of the bits of news that's been around this week has been around this, I think it's a Samaritans-led campaign around listening. And I think, you know, sort of highlighting just the value of listening, not necessarily solving problems or coming to some kind of resolution, but just the value to people of being listened to. And I think this is something that, you know, we potentially can do really, really well within universities. But I think we need to do more of it And I think, as Adam says, you know, in an ideal world, we would have a much wider platform. But we also need sometimes the government to acknowledge that some of their policies have actually narrowed that frame. I mean, the duties under prevent, I think, have been really quite problematic in terms of the way in which we have to balance our responsibilities in relation to both academic freedom and prevent, because sometimes they are in conflict. But I think overall, we do need to have a part to play in, you know, sort of fighting back that the accusations that come through the culture walls, and very much position ourselves as part of the solution in terms of bridging gaps within our communities rather than part of what might exacerbate a problem.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you'll find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Adam and Selena, everyone back at Wonky HQ for making it all happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.